midst of the purified, midst of the free, I plunge in the crimson tide open for me. For skin and unclean is saved on the sand, and point to the print of blood held in his hand. Oh, sing of his mighty love, sing of his mighty love, sing of his mighty love, mighty to save.
Greetings. This is J.C. Yoakum bringing you Hymn Time, your regularly scheduled program of hymn history and singing. King David of old said, O come, let us sing unto the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving and make a joyful noise unto him with psalms. Psalms 95, 1 and 2. David was a man after God's own heart, so we can regard whatever advice he gave as good for the Christian. We hope the hymns we've chosen for today will prove to be a blessing to you. William Cowper spent his early years in an orphan school. The larger boys bullied frail little Cowper. As a result, he developed a twisted outlook on life. As a man, Cowper studied law but couldn't plead cases because of stage fright. A cousin found him a job as a clerk in the House of Lords, but when Cowper learned that he would have to appear before a board of examiners, he suffered a nervous breakdown. But the thing that haunted William Cowper most and eventually drove him to insanity was the belief that God had closed the door of heaven to him. William Cowper was released from St. Albans Asylum in June of 1765. He wandered to the town of Olney, where he was taken in by Mr. John Newton, the converted slave ship captain. Mr. Newton reasoned with Cowper. He set him to visiting members of his parish and writing hymns for the weekly prayer meetings. Thus was born the classic Olney Hymns. William Cowper was in and out of the insane asylum four times, and between his spells of insanity, when he had control of his faculties, he wrote poetry that won for him the reputation of being the greatest poet of his time. But Cowper could never completely shake off the belief that God had turned his back on him. He was known to have attempted suicide four times, but God was not ready for William Cowper to die. It was not until April the 25th of 1800, when he was 69 years old, that William Cowper's time did come. And his passing was not by his own hand, nor was William Cowper allowed to leave this life with the fear that had followed him for so many years. A clergyman who had sat at his bedside has said that half an hour before the little poet died, his face suddenly lighted up with a look of wonder and delight. God had not forgotten William Cowper. Just before he died, the poet's face beamed with a smile, and he said, I am not shut out of heaven after all. Included in the immortal collection Olney Hymns are 67 that were written by William Cowper, among them being God Moves in a Mysterious Way.
God moves in a mysterious way. In wonder to
Oh,
Reginald Heber loved the quiet town of Hodnett with his inherited wealth, his Oxford education, and his family background. The young Anglican minister could have lived in a London mansion. Instead, he built a mansion at Hodnett, preached at the little church there, and gave of his wealth to the poor. Heber was not strong. Perhaps that's the more reason he liked the relaxed life of the small town. His congregation, too, was small, and he had time to write articles for periodicals and hymns for his church. Heber complained to his friends about the psalm singing in his little church. Others were singing the songs of Wesley, Cowper, and Watts, but the Bishop of London said the time was not yet ripe for the singing of hymns in the established church. So Heber wrote his own hymns and used them on special occasions. He wanted to publish them in a book, but the bishop frowned on the idea. So Heber put his poems away in an old family trunk. In 1823, Heber was asked by his superiors to go to India, but he didn't want to leave Hodnett. Twice he declined. On the third request, he gave in, saying that a preacher is like a soldier. He must obey his superiors. He went to India and for 3 years tried to serve a vast majority of a territory. Long travels and strenuous work taxed his strength, and the air was so hot, he said, that it felt as though it blew in from a furnace. On April 3rd, 1826, at the age of 43, Heber went to preach at Trichinopoly. The crowd was so large that he had to stand on the mission steps and deliver his sermon in the hot sun. That afternoon, he took a cool bath, suffered a stroke, and died. Heber's widow found the roll of hymns in the trunk and had them published. In 1861, a London publisher and his staff were studying the poems when they came across a masterpiece. Composer John Dykes was called in. Dykes, with 300 fine compositions to his credit, could compose almost anywhere. He wrote on city streets, on trains, and in railroad stations. Like Lowell Mason, he wrote rapidly. When he left the publisher's office, he left a group of startled men and one of the finest hymn tunes ever composed. The hymn was Holy, Holy, Holy. Words and music, it is one of the most majestic hymns in any book. Reginald Heber wrote 57 hymns, but this was the greatest and was written for his little congregation at Hodnett.
Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, burning in the burning, thy sun shall rise to thee.
Holy, 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 merciful and high.
Isaac Watts has been called and universally accepted as the father of English hymnody. From the pen of Bernard Manning, we have these words: to Isaac Watts, more than to any man, is due the triumph of the hymn in English worship. All hymn writers who followed him, even though they may excel, are his debtors. Mr. Watts was born in 1674, a period of time when hymns of human composure were not allowed in public worship. Only psalms were sung, and these were done line by line as they were read aloud by a leader. Isaac Watts was 18 years old when on a Sunday afternoon in 1692, he was reprimanded by his father for not singing in church. Isaac stated bluntly that there was no music in the Psalms, that they didn't rhyme, and furthermore, that the New Testament church should sing praise to God in the language of the New Testament. His outraged father suggested sarcastically that he try his hand at writing something better than King David. Isaac Watts accepted the challenge, and the result was a complete revolution in church singing. Besides living in an age of great controversy in the church, Mr. Watts suffered many physical infirmities. He knew firsthand of genuine opposition and persecution. Despite all this, he won the time-honored affection of hymn singers the world over. His composition numbers about 600. Out of this wealth, it would be impossible to measure the value of Isaac Watts' effort to Christians. One of his hymns commonly sung today is, "When I Can Read My Title Clear." A true story connected with this hymn is as follows. During the Civil War, word was brought of an approaching attack on Pittsburgh Landing. A Baptist clergyman serving as chaplain and lieutenant was said to have offered a prayer that would never be forgotten by those who heard it. The chaplain soon fell, severely wounded, and lay without water or help for more than 24 hours. His sufferings were terrible, but he declared that he never enjoyed a sweeter experience. Several times he found himself singing, "When I Can Read My Title Clear." The God who watches over all his children shielded him with such particular love that he reached his home in safety some time later. Listen to this great hymn now, "When I Can Read My Title Clear."
When I can read my title
Delilah. lives of English hymn writers, as a rule, show the presence of wealth and culture. Those of Americans, equally as a rule, show the presence and pressure of poverty and hard surroundings. In Dr. Ray Palmer's case, this rule was unaltered. He was born in Little Compton, Rhode Island, November 12, 1808. His early education was received at home, but at the age of 13, was earning his daily bread by working as a clerk in a dry goods store in Boston. It was providential that his steps were soon directed to the Park Street Congregational Church. With this church, young Palmer united, and his gifts and callings in the direction of the ministry were soon apparent. He now took a 3-year course at Phillips Academy at Andover, and from there he went to Yale College and graduated in 1830. He then studied 1 year in New York and 3 years in New Haven. During this time, he burned the candle at both ends by working at different jobs in addition to studying. While teaching at a girls' school and attending college at the same time, he almost gave up. One night, at his boarding house, he wrote a poem in a little morocco-bound notebook, just to read for renewed courage. It began, "My faith looks up to thee, thy Lamb of Calvary." In speaking of the poem years later, Dr. Palmer said, "I expressed what I felt in writing with very little effort. I recollect I wrote the lines with very tender emotion and ended the last line with tears." 2 years later, Ray Palmer stopped in front of a store in Boston to talk to Lowell Mason. Lowell Mason was in the process of compiling material for his book called Spiritual Songs for Social Worship. When Mason asked Palmer to write something for his hymnal, Palmer showed him the poem he had carried in his pocket for 2 years. The composer borrowed a piece of paper and copied the poem. That night, in his studio, Lowell Mason set to music Ray Palmer's first and greatest hymn. 2 or 3 days later, he again met the author on the street. He said, "Mr. Palmer, you may do many good things, but I think you will be best known to posterity as the author of My Faith Looks Up to Thee." And Lowell Mason was right. Although Ray Palmer went on to publish several volumes of verse, he has gone down in history because of that one poem he wrote to bolster his faltering courage. Credit is due also to Lowell Mason, who wrote and an appropriate tune to accompany the stately words of this beautiful hymn we now hear sung, "My Faith Looks Up to Thee."
My faith looks up to thee, thou Lamb of Calvary, Savior divine. Now hear me while I pray, take all my guilt away, pull me from the dead evil.
John Sinnick was born December the 12th, 1718, at Reading, Berkshire, of a family who, on his father's side, were followers of George Fox. His grandparents had been persecuted and imprisoned. He had a strong taste in the direction of asceticism and once subsisted for a time on a diet of acorns, leaves of trees, crab apples, and grass. Don Senick's career was somewhat checkered by disagreements and doctrinal differences with his early associates. He was a reckless and impulsive lad of warm feelings and headstrong character. Although he started out with Wesley, changed to Whitefield, and ended with the Moravians, his sincere and spiritual piety have always been acknowledged by everyone who has commented on his life. One true account of his being bitterly persecuted is as follows. I quote Mr. Senick, "We sang a hymn, and then the devil led on his servants. They began beating a drum, then made fires of gunpowder. At first, the poor flock was startled, but while God gave me power to speak encouragingly to them, they waxed bolder and very few moved. The mob then fired guns over the people's heads and began to play a water machine upon us until we were wet through. They hit us with hogwash, grounds of beer barrels, and muddy water from a ditch. They also pelted us with eggs and stones, threw baskets of dust over us, and fired their guns so close to us that our faces were black with the gunpowder. But we remained praying. I think I never saw or felt so great a power of God as was there." End of quote. There is more to the story, but this suffices to prove that John Senick possessed the Spirit of Christ in an eminent degree. Whatever may have been John Senick's peculiarities, there can be no doubt of his genuine piety. In 1742, he wrote the beautiful hymn, "Children of the Heavenly King." This hymn, dear to all Christians, has been sung to various tunes through the years. Today we hear it in a minor key. Listen to John Senick's "Children of the Heavenly King." Grandfather hitched his team to the Surrey and ground over the dirt road to the meeting house, one of his favorite hymns was, "Must Jesus Bear the Cross Alone?" When your great-grandfather's great-grandfather swung his musket over his shoulder and blazed a path through the thicket to the brush arbor 2 generations before the colonists became a nation, he too sang the same lines, for there were few other hymns in existence. Thomas Shepard wrote it in 1693 while he was minister of the Church of England. The following year, he changed over to the nonconformist and preached in a barn for 7 years until he could raise money enough to build a chapel for his congregation. There have been minor changes, but basically, the verses remain as Shepard wrote them 2.5 centuries ago. The music to which Mr. Shepard's verses are sung today is comparatively modern. American composer George N. Allen wrote the tune about the time Abraham Lincoln was riding circuits of Illinois as a young lawyer. Almost a century older than the United States, Must Jesus Bear the Cross Alone, is the church singing what sterling is to silver. It never grows old. It made its debut in a barn in England. Your great-great-grandfather sang it as he trudged through the wilderness. It is sung today in mahogany wall chapels by Christians around the world. Perhaps your great-grandchildren will sing, Must Jesus Bear the Cross Alone.
Must Jesus
compiled and originates in Cuthbert, Georgia. Your narrator has been J.C. Yocum. We hope you have enjoyed the program today. If so, please write or call your local radio station. And until we join you again with Hymn Time, may God be with you.
God be with you, hear me. Thank you.